Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University, Australia, but I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy Visiting Professor at the University of Copenhagen. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research. So exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I'm wanting is for you to get your exercise information from the research experts rather than influencers. And indeed, today I bring to you Professor Benjamin Miller from the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation, OMRF. He's an expert on proteostasis, so how the muscle in particular maintains its protein levels. So is it protein synthesis? Is it protein breakdown? But not just looking at muscle mass, but looking at all the proteins in muscle and how they're maintained, how they increase with weight training, for example, how they decrease with aging and inactivity. Really coming up with some quite remarkable new sort of paradigm shifting results, especially the effect of aging on muscle nuclei. We also talked about work he's done looking at interactions between medications and exercise. So for example, metformin, which is the main drug given to people with type 2 diabetes, can actually inhibit some of the positive effects of exercise. I found it really interesting. I think you will too, so stick around. Hi, Benjamin, how are you? Thanks for coming on to Inside Exercise.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the invitation to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to have you on because you've been doing some real cutting edge stuff. So we might talk about later. You did some amazing, some interesting work with George Brooks, who's a legend on lactate sort of metabolism, of course. And I've actually asked him to come on a few times, no luck yet. But Michael Rennie, Michael Kerr, who's a big research nowadays with tendons and things. But your muscle proteostasis plasticity, we'll sort of explain what that means, but you know, what determines muscle mass, I guess, and you know, what happens with atrophy, what happens with aging. Really interesting work. Some probably a bit controversial about, you know, whether the muscle's nucleus can sort of keep doing stuff or not. We'll talk about, so whether it's mitotic or not. And other really nice stuff that I'd seen a few years ago, but hadn't actually connected that it was you, that the most probably one of the most important drugs for diabetes, metformin, may actually mess up responses to exercise. So I'm excited to chat.
Yeah, glad to get going.
All right. So first of all, I have to say you're at OMRF in Oklahoma. I wasn't even sure what that is. Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about that? So you're not most people I've chatted to on the podcast are, you know, affiliated with a university or whatever, but why don't you just tell us about that?
So I came here, it's going to be 5 years in August that I've been here, and it's a private research foundation. So, you know, I came here from an academic setting, previously being at Colorado State University for a while. And whereas opposed to like the academic university where we have teaching, research, and service, here we are purely research. So NIH-funded research sort of drives the ship here. And what's nice about it is everybody from the custodians to the people in the cafeteria to us, you know, we know research pays the bills here. So everybody's going in the same direction. And it makes it really nice for doing research. We're small. We're about 54 PIs here running labs, about 400 people total in the institute. But really, everybody here is really well funded. We have really good resources. And it was like when I came here, it was, you know, I finally was, rather than trying to answer questions the best I could with what I had, it sort of opened up my brain to be able to say, okay, now what is the right question? Because I had basically the resources to do almost anything I wanted here. And it's really accelerated my research quite a bit. It's been an amazing experience here.
Wow. So you still, I'm assuming you said NIH, so you still need external funding. It's not like they're just throwing money at you, but there's a lot of resources there. Is there internal sort of grants that you can go for and things like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of local resources for equipment, grants and things like that. But a large part of the foundation is supported by the indirects from NIH grants. So that's a big focus for us here. And actually there's no tenure here or that kind of thing. So you have to be getting grants and preferably NIH grants to sort of keep your position. So there's no dead weight around here, I would say.
Oh, okay. What about, I often wonder, what does it, is it make it harder having getting students coming through the pipeline, like PhD students, when you're not teaching, or you rely on them coming in from, yeah.
Yeah, so I have, so across the street from us, literally across the street, is OU, University of Oklahoma Health Science Center. So I have adjunct appointments over there in like biochemistry. So I can get PhD students through that university through my adjunct appointments. I actually don't. I have a lab of postdocs right now. So in my lab, I have five postdocs currently. It's just the track I've chosen to go right now, and then a bunch of technicians. But, you know, I'm really big on mentoring. I know that's not the point of this podcast, but that's a huge priority in my whole research career. And, you know, having all those postdocs around really keeps me engaged, and it's a lot of fun. And although I don't have the PhDs and undergrads, I still get all these other mentoring opportunities.
Oh, that's nice having that many postdocs.
Yeah.
Probably cranking papers out. That's great. Okay. Now, I often ask at the start, and I think I can tell already looking at you that you're a fit chap. I often ask at the start, you know, did you get into exercise research, you know, later? Were you a sports person, exercising type person, and then got into research, or the other way around? And we were just joking before we came on that you know, it's different, because most of the people I've had on were into exercise initially. But yeah. you wouldn't like interview a cardiac researcher and say, oh, did you have a heart attack, and is that why you got into cardiac research? But
yeah,
but with exercise, with us, it's kind of different, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I was into cycling at a very young age, then played team sports all through high school, and then picked up cycling again. And you know, that's been a big part of my life for like last 25, 30 years. You know, the majority of my life, there's been a bike involved at various, you know, levels of competition and things like that. But, you know, I thought I wanted to go to med school, and I went through a classic exercise phys program during my undergrad. And I did another, you know, I was going to do a master's degree to sort of beef up that med school application. And, you know, once I did my master's, I was really hooked on research, and it was all the reasons I thought I wanted to go to med school were actually what research was, you know? And so I was hooked, and, you know, med school went away. And then I just went on this really linear track from master's to PhD to postdoc to faculty. Yeah, I was, but you know, that getting into an ex-phys program was definitely driven by, you know, some of these interests I had, and they, you know, I had all the prerequisites for medical school, but it was doing something I really enjoyed. So, you know, definitely that's how I got into it.
Now, I was just thinking, I was reading earlier your website, you know, description of your research and all that, and you were talking about how, what is it now, by 2035, there'll be more people over the age of 65 than there will be under 18, which is amazing to think about. But then I was interested to see that you talked about how you want to improve health span more than lifespan, and you literally said you're not thinking you're going to try and get people to live to 150. I mean, this is a thing. I know you're not on Twitter, but there's all sorts of people on Twitter, and I guess you know, but talking about, you know, living longer and that you know, aging is a disease and we should be able to stop it and you should be able to live to 150 and things like that. But I also saw that you do research in animal models where they do live longer, but you're not expecting that in humans. You're really, I mean, maybe a couple of years, but not 150. So you're really trying to work on the health span. Yeah. Did you want to just explain that a bit, expand on that?
Sure. Yeah. So health span is really the buzzword in aging research right now. So it's about adding quality of years, quality to the number of years that you have, rather than extending this maximal lifespan. Now, there is a certain fringe of this area, and it's mostly driven by some really people with a lot of money that are, you know, want to be immortal, basically, and trying to extend lifespan as well. But really, because of the last, you know, quarter of our life to a third of our life, can be spent in disability, you know, we're really trying to just move that to, so that you're spending a very small part of your life with disability. And, you know, that's really the aging research treating like aging as a topic, is because aging is actually the number one risk factor for almost all chronic diseases. So the thought there is that if you treat aging or can slow the aging process, you're simultaneously treating all these diseases. or preventing them. So that, I mean, that is, it's called geroscience now. It's the big focus of aging research, but it's kind of a golden time to be doing aging research because we have all these outside influences now putting money into it because of this want to live such a long time, but that has a trickle-down effect in supporting aging research. And there's always going to be some of this fringe stuff going on that's, you know, you wouldn't call it hard, good science, but, you know, the people in the trenches are really trying to add, you know, quality to the years and prevent the onset of chronic disease.
I guess even the people that want to live to 150 want to still feel better at 80 and 90 as well. So
yeah, and when you do the studies in animals and you use lifespan as a outcome, it's because you assume then that that health span was also improved. It's not always the case, but that's the assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get into that discussion later if you want. It's like, what do we, you know, what do we measure? To when we say improve health span, that's a really easy thing to say, but how do you actually measure that is a whole nother thing.
Okay. Well, do you want to talk about it now?
Sure.
We're just having a chat here. I'm not quite sure. There's a bunch of stuff we want to talk about, but I'm seeing as you brought it up, why don't we just talk about it now?
Sure. I'll just be brief about this. So, you know, when you take a drug to market, say for something like blood pressure, high blood pressure, you know, you measure blood pressure and it's very clear whether that drug worked or not, you know, because you brought down blood pressure. So when we talk about aging, it's like, what do you measure to know that something was effective at slowing that aging process? You know, it's not chronological years or calendar years, because you know that two people that are 75 years old can be completely different biologically. So it's what the field struggles with right now to know that health, we are extending health span, is what do we actually measure to demonstrate that? So if we go to the FDA for a drug for health span, they're, you know, what's the outcome? That's the first thing hurdle you have to cross is what are you going to measure? And that's, you know, that's a big hindrance in the field right now to actually making progress towards extending health span and slowing the aging process. It's just determining what we're going to measure.
So it's not just showing that, you know, the blood, well, naturally, if you've got different experiments, you can show this group has lower blood pressure, better insulin sensitivity, whatever. But is that not enough because you haven't actually got the disease? Well, I guess hypertension. Saying it's so just a little bit.
But you're measuring hypertension then, right? You're not measuring all the other things. What if you're...
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if you're not cognitively sound? You improve blood pressure, but you're, you know, cognitively, you know, losing function and things like that. It's such an integrated thing, the aging. So what to measure to capture all that.
All right. So I want to talk about your aging and maintenance of muscle and how that's done, protein synthesis versus protein breakdown, et cetera. But how about, since we're talking about, you're talking about medications and things, it makes me think about the work you've done there, and we've talked about exercise, with how you looked at metformin. So why don't you just tell people what is metformin, what it's used for, and the study you did looking at metformin versus exercise versus combined, and what you got. And also, I know you've got funding now to look at metformin and health span. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so metformin is the number one prescribed diabetic drug in the world for type 2 diabetes. It's a very well-known drug. Many years of safety data. It's well tolerated. It's cheap. And so metformin has been put forward as one of these potential drugs to slow aging. The reason is, you know, with the epidemiological data and stuff, a couple studies have shown that if, you know, diabetics with metformin, you know, you can extend this life expectancy of someone with diabetes when they're on metformin. And one study showed that the diabetics on metformin actually had a better survival in these later years compared to a control group that didn't have diabetes. Okay. It was like very provocative data. Another study has come out recently that sort of opposes those findings. And then there's some stuff in preclinical models and everything that showed that metformin could potentially slow the aging process. So that's what got me interested in it. When I was at Colorado State, Barry Braun had done some of the original work showing that metformin can acutely decrease VO2 max can do some sort of blunting of improvements in VO2 max. And so we were thinking to ourselves, okay, metformin is supposed to be an AMPK activator. Exercise is supposed to be an AMPK activator. You know, these two things should work together well. One plus one would equal two. And, but there was other things that sort of, you know, indicated to us that largely through Barry's previous work, that metformin may be impairing some of the benefits of exercise. So we did a 12-week exercise training study in older individuals, again, because I'm interested in the aging aspect of this. These were people with at least one risk factor for diabetes, although they didn't have diabetes, type 2 diabetes. 12 weeks of exercise or with or without metformin. So what we saw, and we reproduced some previous findings, that the metformin blunted the increase in VO2 max that you that we saw in the control group that you would expect with aerobic exercise training. So it blunted that almost completely. And then we did biopsies and we did respirometry of the mitochondria, and it very much impaired mitochondrial respiration, the improvements in mitochondrial respiration in these subjects. So blunted the positive, some of these positive effects that you would see from exercise. When we looked at the data in retrospect, after the publication even, we realized that some of the people that entered the study most healthy on the spectrum of people we are looking at were actually the ones that had the biggest impairment from metformin in the exercise improvements. And this includes an oral glucose tolerance test. Like, their improvements in glucose handling from exercise training was almost completely blunted. And the people that came in with the highest mitochondrial function from respirometry were also the ones that came out of the study with the biggest detriments from metformin. And when I say detriments, these people actually, they're OGTTs, they came out of the study worse than when they entered. So they were taking metformin and exercise, and their glucose tolerance actually was decreased after doing 12 weeks of exercise training. So, and then the people that improved the most with this intervention were the ones that came into the study the least healthy. Okay, so then we started to hypothesize that there's a context specificity of this, that, you know, maybe if you're metabolically unhealthy, that metformin potentially has some benefit. But if you're already healthy, then metformin may be worse than no benefit. I mean, it actually might cause some detriments. So that was our speculation.
Sorry, but you didn't have a metformin. Sorry, you had exercise or exercise plus metformin. You didn't have a metformin group alone, is that right?
No, no, because we are only in this study was looking, we're just looking at the exercise. But we do, we have an ongoing clinical trial right now. And this, my co-PI on this is Adam Konopka, who was on that original paper, but now has his own lab at the University of Wisconsin. So we're two sites. We're recruiting subjects that are relatively insulin sensitive and relatively insulin resistant. And there's no exercise in this trial, metformin or control. So we're seeing after 12 weeks of metformin, you know, through a variety of outcomes, we're testing a variety of outcomes, whether your metabolic state actually impacts the positive or negative effects of metformin.
So you're hypothesizing the ones that are worse will improve in metformin, but the ones that are pretty good might not improve or get worse.
Yes, exactly. And then so the other way we're testing this, some of the recent funding that you brought up, is in a rat model. So there's a rat model called the HCR, LCR rats. Maybe when you had John Tifo on, you talked about these.
High capacity, yeah.
Yeah, the high capacity and low capacity runners. And to us, this model is a model of high intrinsic mitochondrial function or low intrinsic mitochondrial function, because they don't exercise. They just have, you know, because of this breeding, have a very high aerobic capacity or low aerobic capacity. And so we're doing metformin treatment in each of those two rat models, with the hypothesis, again, the LCRs are going to benefit from metformin treatment, and the HCRs may have detriment. And we're also actually doing both the exercise training and the no exercise training groups. But the most interesting thing I think about this project is we're doing a lifespan study with the LCRs, the HCRs, metformin treatment or control to see, you know, ultimately my hypothesis is the LCRs are going to live longer than their controls with metformin treatment, whereas the HCRs may have a detriment in lifespan.
Wow. Okay. So just to make sure people are clear that maybe didn't see John Tufo's talk or forgotten it. So yeah, the high capacity runners. So as you said, these rats do not train at all. So they've just been bred. So you have high capacity runner mating with high capacity runner, low capacity runners mating with low capacity runners, and they're up to like 35 generations or something now.
Yeah.
And they just, the high capacity runners just keep running more and more, and they're more healthy. Yeah. And the low capacity runners don't run very well, and they're not very healthy, and they have low capacity VO2 max and things like that. So you're saying you think that the metformin, because the high capacity runners have really good mitochondrial function, you think because the metformin messes around with their mitochondrial function, they may actually struggle more. And the low capacity runners that have low mitochondrial function, there's not much to mess up.
Is
that what you're saying?
And they're going to probably improve.
They may even improve. Yeah, okay. But you're not training them. Oh, you are training them. Oh, you're not.
Yeah, we do have the control group and the exercise train group. So we're going to get at all the questions in the rats.
Ah, so you're going to be training them. That's good. Because, yeah, that's the thing that's weird is that they're not trained. They're just good without training, but you're actually going to train them as well. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, okay, this is just me trying to get my head around it. So then you're saying the high capacity runners, when you train them, they probably won't improve. It'll probably mess them up.
Yeah.
The low capacity runners. Okay. So what do you think of the low capacity runners?
I think they're going to improve either in a control condition or with the exercise training. So there's a lot there to digest.
Okay.
But the reason this is all important is because if you think about people that are interested in extending their health span, you know, they're usually going to be interested in multiple ways of doing that. So physically fit, you know, watching diet. But I've already heard anecdotal stories about people taking metformin because they've seen the potential for it to increase health span. So if people are exercising and taking metformin because they think those things are going to improve their health span and they're taking them at the same time, we're kind of testing whether that's really the case or maybe they're working against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is this is all context specific. Like some people it's going to help, some not, and we're trying to determine who it's going to help and who it's not going to help.
This is interesting. It's very interesting, obviously, but it's also making me think about a few years ago. There was this bariatric surgery top bariatric surgery guy in Australia, and he gave a talk, and anyway, he was saying like. And then there was other people talking about metformin, for example, and they were saying it's at the point now that rather than saying to people with diabetes, you know, why don't you improve your diet, you know, assuming they need to improve their diet and do some exercise, rather than doing that, and then later on, if their diabetes doesn't improve or if they don't adhere to it, then putting them on metformin.
Yeah.
This person was saying they just put them on metformin straight away now. And it's like, holy crap, you know, you'd like to think. Because they're saying because people don't adhere to the diet and exercise, so all you've done is wasted 6 months, he's saying, which I personally is like kind of an affront to me. But, you know, I've got diabetes and I'm not seeing people with diabetes day in, day out. So anyway, that's an interesting one because there you're saying, well, it'd be better if you, and the assumption was even if they went on metformin, they could still exercise, you know, they could still, you know, be on a good diet. But you're saying that's maybe not so clear anyway.
Well, you know, in the people that are not metabolically healthy, it might be okay. But I'm worried about right now the people that are in good health, because if you're trying to, our rationale is that if you want to extend the period of health span, that means you start treatments while you're still healthy. Like,
I've been assuming you're talking about people with diabetes. You're talking about people that don't have diabetes that are taking metformin.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because they heard that it increases health span. Because there's some loud voices in the field that have really advocated for metformin as one of these health span treatments.
Okay, all right. So you're saying if you're healthy, and you want to live longer, you wouldn't, your feeling is, you know, you still need to do more research. It wouldn't be smart to take that form. Is that a takeaway?
Oh, yes, that's the hypothesis. Obviously, we have to do all the experiments. But yeah, that's the hypothesis we're entering with.
And another thing I saw is that you, I don't know if it was an email to me or it was on your website, to be honest, but you were saying that the best thing anyway is to do exercise. So if you've got someone who's healthy or someone who's got diabetes, is it correct? I want to put words in your mouth. You'd be pushing exercise more than these other treatments anyway, or?
So this is something that I've been saying a lot more lately, because I think it, because, you know, I've crossed over from this exercise in you know, muscle fields, which I'm still involved in the muscle fields a lot. And, you know, I considered myself trained as a physiologist, but then I entered into this aging field. So one of the primary meetings I go to now are aging related. So I, you know, there's some really hot drugs in the aging area. So metformin being one of them, rapamycin and a couple of other ones. And, you know, we work with all of these. But what I find myself saying more now, because I think it needs to be said, is all these drugs that we're testing are just trying to be as good as exercise. Like, we know exercise works for health span, and it works really well. And it has multiple targets, multiple effects. So all these drugs we're testing are really just trying to be as good as exercise. So yes, I still think exercise is the gold standard for health span.
Exactly. And then also, you know, people talk about an exercise pill, an exercise mimetic, but to get all the different things in, the anxiety reducing, the blood pressure reducing, the improving your lipids, the insulin sensitivity, it's going to take more than one pill, one sort of mechanism you're trying to get at.
But that, those kinds of things are really obvious to us that came up through exercise physiology and that training and things like that. That's like a no-brainer to us. But when you wander into some other fields, that's not always clear. And I guess I was surprised by that.
All right. Now, that I'm glad you mentioned, mentioned rapamycin, which is related to mTOR, mTORC. So another thing I want to talk about with you is with aging muscle. You know, people are interested in trying to activate mTORC, but you've mentioned that in your papers and things that it's already activated. And anyway, so looking at people assuming that with aging, you're getting loss of muscle because of loss of a reduction in protein synthesis. And you've been looking at whether perhaps it might be protein breakdown and things. So why don't you tell us about all that?
Okay. The term we've been using a lot is this idea of proteostasis. So it's protein homeostasis, you know, not that complicated of a word. So the maintenance of the proteins functioning in a way that they're supposed to, and, you know, rather than a decline in proteostasis over time, or a decline in proteostatic mechanisms to maintain the proteome, that results in damaged and proteins that are less functional or aggregated or whatever else. So, you know, with Alzheimer's disease, you know, a lot of people know you get these aggregates in the brain, these protein aggregates, and that's a failure to maintain proteostasis, are those aggregates. Turns out you get those in muscle too. So you get them in other places as well. It's just very well known in the brain. So we are really focused on maintaining the proteome, because we know that decline of muscle function is often more so and more rapid than the decline in muscle mass. So muscle mass predicts a lot of muscle function, but it's not the sole thing. So we've been really focused on maintaining the proteome rather than maintaining protein mass per se.
Okay.
So what we have, you know, and I entered this field, you know, doing tracer studies to measure protein synthesis in aging, you know, I was fully on board with the fact that this is a protein synthesis problem. And in my mind, you know, just amping up protein synthesis is the solution to this problem. You know, what can we do with aged individuals to improve protein synthesis? And I finally had to come to grips with some of our studies when we directly compared aged and adult, more, you know, repeatedly, that the aged already had higher protein synthesis than the adult. So I'm sitting here wondering, well, why are we trying to even amp that up anymore if it's not solving the problem. And not all studies reproduce that. You know, we've seen it a number of times. And I think it's because of the tracer approaches we use. And we don't have to go into that, but we use long-term labeling with deuterium oxide. You know, a lot of the literature started with the short 4 to 6 hour infusions with labeled amino acids. And I think there's a difference there. But now, you know, now we're getting into disuse and the reloading after disuse and the failure to regain mass. And over and over and over, we're seeing that the older individuals increase protein synthesis, or older animals increase protein synthesis just fine. So we started to think about, well, what is the problem? And that has led us to looking at other things such as protein breakdown. You know, we're getting a little bit into the chaperoning and protein folding type things. You know, we see an amping up of ribosomal biogenesis just fine, which is what you need. So to me, it's becoming a question of maybe they're making all the protein they need, but maybe they're doing it in a way that it's maybe at too high of a rate, that these proteins aren't being processed appropriately to be functional. So maybe the rate at which it's going right now is actually part of the problem. You know, that's where we are right now in our thought process.
So can I just make sure I'm on the right page here, and everyone else is as well. So you're saying, so it's been assumed that, I'm glad you pointed that out, because I was thinking muscle mass, but you're talking about the whole proteome. So all the proteins that have been produced and broken down, you're talking about having all of those working properly and not aggregating and things like that. So, but you're saying with age, you actually, you know, the assumption was you're getting a reduction in protein synthesis, and that's why you're getting less muscle mass and less proteins and whatever. But you're saying they've actually got higher protein synthesis than the younger. So these are animal studies, and that the M talk is actually elevated as well, which matches that, because that's a major regulator of protein synthesis. All right. Now, do you find that as well? Is that the same in humans? So if you just did a biopsy, or you know, you did your labeled water, do you find protein synthesis in mTOR is elevated in aged people as well or not?
So, you know, since I've started using these methods, I actually have not done the study of age, you know, at the same time, aged in the same study, aged in adult individuals. So all of this that I'm talking about right now is based on both mouse and rat studies that we're seeing this. I haven't combed the literature to look at some of these same outcomes in adult and old humans using deuterium oxide. You know, I don't know if that study, I don't know if that study is out there.
What about just mTOR?
A lot of times, because of the way people are using, you know, when you make your mTOR measurements and, you know, it's hard to find studies where they actually use that as an outcome and compare adult and old directly. It's surprising if you go look for it. It's hard to find.
That's weird.
Yeah. Hmm. So, you know, a lot of these recommendations that we were giving to older folks, you know, we know in adult and young people that increasing mTOR activity and, you know, by these amino acid feedings and everything like that, or leucine, you know, that amps up protein synthesis quite nicely. But, you know, this is what we've learned when you do aging studies, the aging muscle is not exactly the same as the adult muscle. So if that mTOR activity is already high, you know, we don't know that you can turn it up even higher, you know, and that will have a benefit. It's the same thing with obesity. You know, chronic obesity, you know, obesity is known to have chronically elevated mTOR activity, you know, because you're in this hypernutrient sort of state all the time. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that older individuals have high mTOR activity, because we see it in other sort of disease conditions as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So yeah, you were starting to say, so their protein synthesis, if anything, is elevated compared to the non-aged animals. And then you're saying, but you've also found that their protein breakdown is higher.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it has to be, you know, to yeah, have a lots of mass. Yeah. But there's a point in there that it gets into the weeds a little bit. And I'm actually writing a little paper on this right now, but when we talk about muscle protein synthesis, we talk about it like it's a thing, it's one thing. But you know, there's thousands of proteins in a muscle. Mm-hmm. And so when we say muscle protein synthesis is increased or decreased, the reality is on average, that's increased or decreased. But if you look at all the individual proteins, half of them are going up, half of them are going down. And in any sort of intervention, and that's just, you know, that's a principle of adaptation. You can't have everything going, you don't have the energetic resources to make everything amp up. So I think that nuance in discussion becomes important. Okay, so what proteins are up and what ones are down when we're talking about the proteome and having well-functioning muscle?
Yeah, and that just made me think there's a concept of futile cycling where you're doing a reaction that's just burning energy. It makes me think about that with these aged muscles. If they've got higher protein synthesis and higher protein breakdown, that's expensive, right?
Yeah, and I've had that same thought process. Yeah. or else you have some going up and maybe they're not the right ones, not the ones that you actually need, you know?
Exactly. All right. So that's interesting. Now, the other thing you've had is something that was pretty surprising. So some pretty sort of hot findings you've had with this concept of myonuclei. So the nucleuses, which is nuclei in muscle. So why don't you just talk to us about muscle myonuclei? So muscle nucleuses, which is nuclei. But anyway, how it's multinucleated. And the idea that it's post-mitotic and all that, and your recent findings on why they're important.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a fairly, not a super long study, but I'll give you some background here. So yes, myofibers are multinucleated, and we've known that that's one of the cool things about muscle, I guess. It's because it's such a large cell. A myofiber is, you know, fivefold bigger than most of the cell types in our body. So it needs
interject there because I always think about this. So, you know, I've had a lot of muscle biopsies and I just want people to realize how amazingly small things are though. So muscle biopsy, we usually say one or two rice grains or something. And, you know, when I had my fiber type done, there was 572 fibers in this tiny little sample. Yeah. And you're saying each one is a myofiber, a muscle fiber. And you're saying they're big compared to other cells. And then each fiber of those 572 in my muscle biopsy would have more than one nucleus.
So they have, you know, they can have hundreds of nuclei along a very long muscle fiber, because there's this thing called the myonuclear domain or cytosolic domain. When you're talking to general cell type, it's like the idea that a nuclei regulates a certain area of the cytoplasm. So if you have a very large cell, you need more nuclear material to manage that increased area. So the way the myofibers do that is it's thought that they were post-mitotic, so they're stuck in this G0 phase of the cell cycle. So they exit the cell cycle after development. They're stuck in G0.
Just explain what you mean there.
Yeah, so they don't wrap the DNA. You don't go through these mitotic events in the nuclei in myofibers.
They're not dividing.
Yeah. Right. So they're stuck. And there's probably good reason for that. There's probably there's the muscle fiber itself is really packed in with all these myofibers, mitochondria, and everything like that. So there's some spatial constraints and things. But so the thought is that satellite cells that reside on the periphery self-replicate and then donate nuclei. When the muscle fiber does need more nuclei, they come from the satellite cells. And adding more nuclei then allows that muscle fiber to get bigger because it can handle this increased volume of cytoplasm. So that's the thought. So when we were doing our D2O approaches, even from our first study in humans, we were trying to measure one thing, mitochondrial DNA replication, and I won't go into that, But we kept finding nuclear DNA replication in muscle cells. And when we do a biopsy or take muscle from an animal, we saw this repeatedly. We saw that with some hypertrophy events, these rates would go up. And we saw with atrophy events, they could go down. So we are starting to wonder, why do we keep measuring DNA synthesis in a cell, in a tissue type that's largely thought to be post-mitotic? So then we thought, okay, it was the satellite cells and maybe some of the other supportive cell types, because there's many cell types in a muscle tissue. But so we're like, well, why don't we try to answer this question directly? And working with some folks at the University of Kentucky, namely John McCarthy and Esther DuPont-Verstegden, we are able to generate, or John developed this mouse model that allowed us to specifically label myonuclei and do so in a way that we could turn it on and off. Then we used our tracer approach. So in a way that allowed us to definitively know that the DNA synthesis that we were measuring was only from a myonuclei and not any other cell type. And when we did that study, what we found is that myonuclei were replicating their DNA. Okay. So that goes against the dogma that they're stuck in this G0 non-replicative state. So I don't actually think they're making more nuclei. What I think is happening is something called endoreplication, where you end up with polyploidy, where you end up with multiple copies of the DNA within a nuclei. The liver does this, the heart does it as well. So I think that that is happening, you know, expanding your genetic material and allows you then to manage, have more DNA material without a satellite cell doing it.
Okay, all right. So there's quite a lot of stuff there. So to make it simple, I guess, so you're saying that this myonuclei domain, so you have a lot of nuclei because they are sort of looking after a small sort of part of the whole muscle fiber, yeah? So then if you're doing weight training, for example, and you get an increase in your myofiber size, you know, what do you do about that? And the idea is that people have generally thought that these satellite cells would come in and they would divide, and then you'd still have another satellite cell, and the one that just divided would then be involved in another forming another nucleus. Is that right? And then that, so then you keep your ratio of sort of nucleus to the rest, cytoplasm, etc. The same. But you're not saying that satellite cells aren't doing anything at all, but you're saying that you're able to duplicate that nuclei that's already there, and then that performs that role. Is that right?
Yeah. So, yes, it's exactly what we are saying. And one of the studies we did in this study, one of the sub-studies within this publication, we actually ablated satellite cells as well. We took them out of the picture completely.
Mm-hmm. How did you do that? I'm interested.
It's another model the Kentucky group has come up with. It's called the PAC7 DTA. So diphtheria toxin selectively, gets rid of the DNA in satellite cells. Okay. Or, so ablates basically the satellite cells. So we were able to do that at the same time, and we saw no change in our rates that we were measuring in the DNA synthesis. So what that told us was that the DNA synthesis that we were seeing in myonuclei may accounted for, at least in a non-perturbed state, all the DNA synthesis, and it wasn't satellite cells at all. Now, if you do something like overloading, that story might change.
All right. So what are the satellites? Because satellite cells are getting activated and things, right? What are they doing then if they're not
doing well? This is a whole area of controversy, and not one that I've only been peripherally watching, but that's, you know, the work of the Kentucky folks who have taken away, who have ablated satellite cells and found that the muscle, you know, can hypertrophy just fine or does not have accelerated sarcopenia. But some of the work by Chris Fry at Kentucky right now has done some really interesting work that this actually has impacts on fibrogenesis and some other functions that are not directly, you know, purely for this donation of nuclei for muscle size, but it definitely has a function for sure.
I make another suggestion is because you know the stuff we've looked at, like what regulates glucose uptake during exercise. So you know we've shown if you knock out AMPK, you know it's still normal, and you other people if you knock out CAM kinase, it's still normal. It doesn't mean they're not playing a role. But other things can compensate. So is it possible that if you knock out your satellite cells, well, although you said they didn't increase their DNA production, but maybe there was enough.
That was my hypothesis. Yeah. My hypothesis was that it would compensate for the lack of it, but we saw no change.
There's no compensation. Okay. And just out of
again, we still have to do the loading experiments and things like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So out of interest, because I know you sent an email to me that you love talking about traces, and I've done quite a lot of traces stuff as well, but different. Just for the people that might be interested, I do put time, I always mean to tell people this, I put timestamps in there, so if you don't want to hear about this bit, you can skip forward. Because I know that I had Herman Ponser on, you know, and he was talking about using, so you said D2O, so it's deuterium. So basically the hydrogen, instead of having one proton and one neutron, it's got two, so it's slightly heavier. That means you can actually see it in the mass spec and all this stuff. But anyway, so you use this deuterated water, basically, D2O. Now, he uses it to look at energy expenditure, but you're looking at a incorporation into proteins and DNA and things. Do you want to just explain how that works and what's going on? I guess you just isolate the nuclei.
So we give it... The one of the primary advantages of it is that it's water. So if we're doing a rodent study, we put it in their drinking water. If we human study, they just drink a bit of it every day. You know, you could have taken yours right there in that sip of water. And then, you know, if we're doing in vitro study, we'd put it in the culture. But so it goes into this body water pool. And then all your intermediary reactions of things like amino acids and other things, they can equilibrate that deuterium with the water pool. So alanine has four of its hydrogens that can exchange with those heavy deuteriums in the water pool. So when we're looking at, say, bulk protein synthesis, we're really analyzing on the GC for alanine enrichment of the protein. So our precursor then is really the labeled alanine with deuterium, and the product is then the muscle protein that has labeled alanine. You can choose any amino acid. Alanine is just one that works really well for a number of reasons. When we look at DNA, then we are looking, those deuteriums can get into the deoxyribose backbone, basically. And all of those then get incorporated into the DNA. We can do this with RNA as well. So we measure RNA synthesis as well looking at, you know, the ribose unit that incorporates the deuterium and that incorporation into the RNA.
Okay, so for people that you're saying deoxyribose, so, you know, DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, correct?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I said it slightly wrong. Okay, and then, so I guess I didn't get that because the tracer stuff I've done has been deuterated glucose, you know, 6,6-dideuterated glucose sort of thing.
Yeah.
So this is showing my own ignorance, I guess. So when I had that sip of water, you're saying that water then it gets broken down into what, hydroxyl and hydrogen ion or something, and then that gets incorporated into alanine.
Well, if you drank that D2O and say that glass of water was 99% D2O and you just drank 50 mils of it, that just like any other pool, that deuterium oxide, that water that has the heavy hydrogen, equilibrates with your body water pool in the volume that you brought it in. It's not like breaking down and stuff, but you know, hydrogens are constantly jumping on, jumping off, and that thing.
That's the thing I didn't get. So I guess with our glucose studies, we were just always assuming that it was just dilution of the tracer. So you're infusing 6,6-dideuterated glucose and you're assuming that didn't jump off. It was still stayed.
Because some of them are non-exchangeable. So some of those hydrogens are non-exchangeable. Other ones are exchangeable. But some of them get incorporated through metabolic processes into these non-exchangeable sites. So that's the magic of it, or that's the beauty of it.
That is the magic of it. So anyway, people can go, if they're interested, they can click on that timestamp. If not, they can go. But I thought rather than asking you later, I'll ask you now. All right, great. So actually, a couple of things I saw before we came on, I was looking around some interesting things. So something, a paper just came out. Maya, and you, I'm not saying you know about this, but just out of interest for people, let's say that when people, you know, hypertrophy, they get an increase in their myonuclei. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Although, hang on, weren't we just saying, oh yeah, you asked, sorry, were you saying that or not? Or were you
yeah, it doesn't, so there, you know, this concept of myonuclear domain and that there's this fixed number of nuclei per volume. So Kevin Mirok has actually written about this a bit, that there's some flexibility in that domain. He's not the only one. There's other people I've written about it as well, that it's not, it's a good concept, but it's not strictly fixed at this one number. And what I'm kind of like, it does work in general, but what we're kind of saying is with this little bit of flexibility in these numbers or this ratio, you know, having more nuclear material in a given nuclei might account for some of that apparent flexibility in that domain.
Okay.
So it might be an unaccounted for factor.
So what I was going to say is I saw something that said people that have taken a lot of anabolic steroids have an increase in their myonuclei, mm-hmm. and that may even stay after they've stopped several years.
Yeah.
So I think I've got confused here.
Right, and that might give rise to this muscle memory effect.
Ah, and then I saw another one that said, yeah, muscle, they're saying it wasn't, what were they saying? So some people are thinking the myonuclei, so if you do weight training, you get an increase in myonuclei, and then the concept is that they may remain even when you stop training. But they're saying that that's not the case, because when you atrophy, then you lose some of the myonuclei as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, that area has been discussed for a long time. I think now people are finally starting to do some really good studies in you know, addressing those questions.
Yeah, and what about, I guess, atrophy? Because we tend to tie them together. Like I saw in the review, it was a meta-analysis talking about myonuclei and they were sort of just saying atrophy / aging. But these are obviously very different things, right? So if you're, you know, I've broken my, managed to break my clavicle 2 weeks ago in a bike crash. It annoyed me because I was about to go to the Tour de France and have a look. But anyway, I didn't go. But anyway, the atrophy I'm getting in my bicep, which is terrible because it's already tiny, is very different to aging, right? You can't just sort of say atrophy / aging.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, can you assume the same mechanisms are going on? No, surely not.
No, I don't think so. I mean, one happens very rapidly. One happens over this very prolonged period of time. So I think they're not the same. And they're not just the opposite of hypertrophy either.
Yeah, so I guess you can't just assume, like, I look at that little fellow there and go, okay, protein synthesis is turned off and maybe muscle, you know, protein breakdown's gone up as well and whatever, which makes perfect sense. I can't complain with the young chap there. Getting tiny like he is, that it's a waste of energy, right? Because as far as my body thinks, I'm like, I'm not going to use this arm anymore. So it's
breaking
it all down, right? Which makes sense. Which almost brings us back to the weird thing that with aging, you've got, well, in rodents anyway, which you'll need to find out, that you've actually got the muscles are getting smaller, but they've got higher protein synthesis and then even higher again breakdown, which is really, really weird.
Or the other thing is that they're ending up in some non-functional aggregate or something like that, you know? So those are some of the possibilities.
Yeah. And again, sorry, I keep talking about protein like it's just one thing. But as you said earlier, you know, you're talking about protein aggregates, you're talking about some proteins go up, some go down. You know, if you did a proteome, you'd see that they're not just all going up and all going down. I mean, it'd be nice if it was, but we're much more complicated than that. Now, you mentioned Kevin Mirok before. So he said something on Twitter. I think he might have been having a bit of a laugh almost. He said, you know, why don't you ask Benjamin to talk about what happens with protein synthesis versus breakdown with aging? So we've obviously talked about that.
Yeah.
I just like to bring up things that people have asked about on Twitter. There was one about, where was that? George, what form of exercise has the greatest impact on mitochondria? Oh, yeah. So we haven't actually talked about mitochondria, and you've done a lot of work with mitochondria. So maybe why don't we just talk a little bit about mitochondria and aging, and then maybe think about George's question here, what sort of exercise is the greatest impact on mitochondria density or efficiency short intense VO2 type or long, slow zone one, zone two. So let's not worry about zone one, two, zone yeah. two, but you know, the concept of the kind of the HIIT training versus the lower intensity. Yeah. I guess there's a lot, I've just thrown a lot at you there, but.
So mitochondria is a primary interest for us. And this gets back to my interest in energetics. So making proteins, very, as you pointed out earlier, very energetically costly. Okay, so to me, a lot of this, what regulates what proteins we make and the rate at which we make them is probably dictated a lot by the energetics of the cell, you know, which comes down to mitochondria. So it's also the reason why, you know, sometimes when I think we look at muscle studies and we're relying on these transcript databases and, or, you know, data sets and stuff, there's this whole translational part. You know, mTOR is your translational regulator that's impacted by AMPK. Obviously there's, you know, there's what the cell wants to do or should do. And it's what it has the energetic capacity to do. You know, you just can't make everything. So there's trade-offs there. So we're really interested in that translational regulation, and we're interested in the mitochondria and how that interacts with all that. And so mitochondria themselves are just big bags of proteins. So they have to maintain themselves as well. So there's a complicated interaction there. So we've really focused on mitochondrial respiration and capacity in a lot of our studies and remodeling of the mitochondrial proteome. So even to the extent that for aging muscle, we think if you can maintain mitochondria and the mitochondrial proteome, that's going to give you this playing field that allows you to adapt much better overall in your muscle. So it's not strictly just about adding mass. It's about, you know, having the energetic capacity to adapt to these stresses that are imposed upon it.
So it's almost metabolic flexibility as well, right? Which is a term that sort of gets bandied around.
Yeah.
Well, there was the thing about what's the best, but this isn't really your research work. So I think people should have a look at earlier studies, podcasts by, you know, Marty Gabbana and various other ones. You know, we've talked about, is it best to high intensity? So, I mean, a whole bunch of stuff we talked about with Michael Joyner and all that, you know, different types of training for adaptations. Now, a chap, Mark, also said, what are the current future pharmacological, you may not know this, but pharmacological interventions to support or supplement exercise for healthy muscular aging? So we talked about one, metformin. Is there other drugs that people are sort of looking at, you know, that sort of, you know, your original idea, like metformin plus exercise might be better than either one alone sort of thing. Are people looking at that?
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about aging per se, you know, the hot drugs right now are rapamycin, metformin, for better or for worse, something called acarbose, which is actually another diabetic drug, 17 alpha estradiol if you're male. This is it's not 17 beta, it's not a class, it's not the estrogen that we all know of, it's an enantiomer of it. Works very well in males. And then the senolytics, which is a whole area of class of drugs that target senescent cells and gets rid of those senescent cells. Because the idea is that these senescent cells are kind of like this rotten apple in a bag of apples. As it rots everything else around them. So if you get rid of that cell, it keeps it from secreting all these things that impact all the other cell types around it. So those are the hot areas. So how many of those are being done in interaction with exercise it's kind of a new area. There's not a lot out there yet. You know, John Tifo, who you had on before, not specific to muscle, you know, he had done the statin and exercise studies. So I think a lot of these, you know, SGLT2 inhibitors are going to be, you know, becoming more and more prescribed. So we did a little bit with that, but there's a lot to be done with SGLT2 inhibitors and exercise. So I think for the purpose of muscle aging, these interactions of these drugs and exercise is still a relatively unexplored area.
That's interesting you mentioned the statins. It reminded me, I saw you had a review, I think in 2020 with John Tifo.
Yeah.
Talking about metformin, statins, and exercise. because we did a study years ago as well. Because the idea that statins, which you know reduce cholesterol by inhibiting HMG-CoA reductase, can also mess up muscle, and quite often people have to shop around. So it's another right. situation. You know, try different statins because it's another situation where there's an interaction and maybe a negative effect with exercise and the drug. Just go back. Just do exercise. Because it's not the drug. It's not exercise screwing up the drug. It's the drug is like, go away. Just exercise.
Yeah, maybe. That would be ideal. Mm-hmm. But what percentage of, at least in America, do people, I think it's something like less than 20% are getting the recommended physical activity. So
that's true. All right. Now, we've had a good chat about what you've been doing lately. Is there any other stuff you want to bring up lately? Because I wanted to bring up some stuff you did years ago, which I think is
That's fine. We can talk about those things.
All right. So, yeah, I said at the start you'd done some work with. So George Brooks, it's interesting that you actually did a lactate infusion during exercise in humans. And this is interesting because we had Andy Coggan on, and Andy, there's this idea about, you know, if you do low intensity exercise, you focus on burning fat. And as you mm-hmm. go harder, you burn more carbohydrate, and you produce more lactate and things. And there's this idea that if you go harder, you get this lactate, and then that messes up your fat oxidation. As far as I know, your lactate infusion study during exercise did not mess up fat oxidation. But why don't you tell us? I mean, that wasn't the main focus anyway, but it's interesting. I just saw, oh, you worked with George Brooks. That's interesting. And I invited him one of the times.
Yeah. Yeah, we did these, what we called a lactate clamp at the time, kind of like a glucose clamp, but with a lactate infusion. So we did those first, I mentioned you offline here that, you know, the very first time we did that, I did it on myself. So I double checked my calculations. We made sure there's a physician there and everything like that. And so we started doing these infusions to get lactate as sort of dissociate lactate from the actual exercise intensity. So say you're doing a 55% VO2 max effort, and then the lactate levels are up at what you would see during 65% of your VO2 max. Mm-hmm. So we are kind of uncoupling those two things. And what we found with all of our tracer studies were quite interesting is that when you gave the lactate, the liver would use that lactate more to make glucose. Your muscle would use the lactate and decrease the amount of glucose use. So it was often being used as a preferred fuel, you know, when we increase the concentration. Those were great. Those were really interesting studies. There's a paper I did a couple years after that I don't think it's ever been cited by anybody, but we did the same lactate infusion during a time trial, like a 20K time trial in human subjects, and increased their, and none of them had, there was no detriment in performance whatsoever. It actually, some people actually did better with the lactate infusion than without it. And these were all out efforts for 20K, which is a really high intensity effort. Like I said, I don't think anybody's ever seen that paper, but it clearly didn't have those detrimental effects you would predict. And, you know, often spare, I'd call it glucose sparing in a way as well.
Well, it's funny because when you first think about it, back then when you did it, you think, oh, it might mess things up. But as we know, you know, the lactic acid dissociates to a hydrogen ion and a lactate ion. And it's the hydrogen ion that's been a debate about whether it can affect muscle contraction and calcium release channels and all this sort of stuff. But the lactate itself is just like three carbons that can be put together, you know, two of them put together in the liver to make glucose. And it can be, the lactate can be converted to pyruvate and broken down in the mitochondria for energy. So it makes sense, right, that it would, if anything, you're just giving more energy to the muscle. That it would either make no difference or you'd actually do better. And is that when George Brooks came out with his lactate drinks?
Those existed before our study. Yeah. Okay. So I want to, I mean, I just want to highlight, so, you know, I had forgotten about I'd gone away from those lactate studies for quite a while, but I recently got involved, a researcher at KU Medical Center named Jill Morris, who's interested in Alzheimer's, and she does human clinical trials. And, you know, when people with, Alzheimer's or mild cognitive impairment, when they exercise, there's this window of period after they exercise that they actually have an improved cognitive function. And So we know that lactate goes to the brain as a fuel. So Jill was interested is whether this improvement in cognitive function in that window after a bout of exercise was actually due to the lactate. So we've actually resurrected this lactate infusion method. And I sort of walked Jill through doing how to do these studies. So they're doing lactate infusions to see if that is what's causing this improvement in cognition that we normally ascribe to a bout of exercise.
It's interesting. Yeah, I was thinking when you earlier said that concept of, you know, you might be exercising at 50%, and then you infuse lactate to put it up at 65 or whatever. It reminded me of the stuff, because I did my PhD with Mark Hargraves and with Mark Fabreo and Matt Watt and all that. They do, I don't know if you remember that, they do like, I don't know, like 80% VO2 max and look at the adrenaline levels, then 50% VO2 max, and then 50% plus the adrenaline to get the same. It's a nice model.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think Michael Kerr did that too with liver glucose output. Yeah.
Right. You know, the one tricky thing about these lactate infusions is you don't infuse the lactate anion. You know, it's just you can't do that. So you have to do it as a sodium lactate infusion. We always have to
osmotic
for the sodium as well.
Which has become
giving a fairly good sodium load. Yeah.
Exactly right. Now, it's funny, I didn't mean to make that beautiful segue there, but Michael Kerr, I just realized that I think he did the adrenaline infusions as well. But yeah, you were on a paper, you know, first author with Michael Kerr last, who's from Copenhagen here, looking at tendon. Was it? I know he looks at tendon stuff. Is that, not, and you said you did your postdoc with him. So what was that?
Yeah, so when I went to Michael's lab, you know, I obviously had this tracer training in George's lab, mostly looking at carbohydrate and glycerol and those kind of tracers. But then when I went to Michael's lab, they were getting into extracellular matrix. That's when Michael changed from, you know, primarily glucose metabolism to, you know, tendon and extracellular matrix and collagen turnover. So we really did the first tracer studies. I came on board and did the first tracer studies with Michael of extracellular matrix turnover. And then so Michael Rennie was simultaneously developing those methods. So we did it kind of as a together. And so we wound up doing the first measurements of tendon collagen synthesis in humans. We also did extracellular matrix or collagen turnover in the muscle. And we tied this all in with the muscle protein synthesis and things like that as well, after a bout of exercise. So really interesting studies. Nice. I had to validate a number of tracer approaches. We were using a lot of money worth of tracers in those studies, which was pretty nerve-wracking. You want to make sure you get your tissue. But they were a really interesting study in some of the first measures of in humans of collagen turnover using tracers.
Hmm. So did you find, was it more like a methodological study, or did you actually look at, you know, did exercise increase it and things like that?
Yeah, we saw that the tendon collagen increased in a similar pattern as the muscle as well. So there's this tying together, so this sort of adapting as a unit, both the muscle and the extracellular matrix and the tendon kind of all adapting together over a similar time scale. Now, knowing what I've learned since then, I would do a lot of those studies. Those were all short-term infusions or bolus infusions and things. Now that we're using deuterium oxide, I've done a lot of these similar studies in rodent models and such that have allowed me to understand way more about collagen and how it's operating. Those studies are some of my favorite studies right now. And I think the most interesting are how the extracellular matrix and the collagen is adapting in muscle. And we've also looked at cartilage and some other things as well. So,
why don't you just tell us that quickly then? Why don't you just tell us quickly then?
What we find, which I think is super interesting, is that when we look at something like collagen or muscle or whatever, the assumption when you do a tracer is that, or with anything, we always assume that all of those proteins will turn over at some point. So that 100% of that protein pool will renew. What we're finding in extracellular matrix and collagen is that a very small proportion of the extracellular matrix or the collagen is actually turning over. And I guess intuitively that makes sense that, you know, you have this, what I think of visually as like a rigid core that's sort of in place, and it's only the stuff on the outside that's actually remodeling. So if we assume that 100% of that collagen actually turns over, it really is misleading in the calculated results. And what we're finding is that only a small, like 20% in some muscles, even in adult, not old, of that collagen actually renews. The rest of it doesn't budge. So to me, like how much of your protein is turning over is actually almost as important as the rate at which it's turning over.
Okay. So then you can't just do a measurement and then, because it's actually diluting your, because if you look at the whole tissue, you'd be diluting what's actually going on in the ones that are turning over.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So we think is some of it is actually turning over at a high rate, but a lot of it's not turning over at all.
And this might actually help you out a little bit with your myonuclei, because I know you found that it was only a small amount of your muscle nuclei that were actually producing more DNA.
Yeah.
And so that might actually fit that, you know, the assumption is, why isn't it all doing it, you know?
Yeah, so exactly. So when we did those measurements with DNA, we thought it was going to be a rare event. So we labeled for a very long time, eight to 10 weeks in that study. So I think what we were doing is really the values that we measure that are very low are not because it's a slow rate, but actually because it's a small population that is replicating probably pretty rapidly, but a very small population. So we've recently are going to, you know, working on doing those studies to determine, is it all myonuclei that replicate very slowly, or is it just a really small population that do it at a high rate?
So I wonder if it's to do with what's actually going on in the cell, that area, you know what I mean? Because we tend to think if you're doing a bicep curl and you're doing full range of motion, for example, you tend to think the whole fiber is doing the same thing. But, you know, I know I had Brad Schoenfeld on recently, and he was talking about if you do your muscle contractions at a long length, you would adaptations at the long length, and which, you know, kind of makes sense. But, you know, I wonder if it's the myonuclei in that area that are actually doing stuff because they need to, and other areas aren't.
Yeah, there's some good data when you look at the transcriptional heterogeneity of nuclei within a muscle fiber or among muscle fibers. The ones that are in the area of neuromuscular junctions have particularly different activity. So Abigail Mackey recently, she's in Copenhagen as well, recently published the myotendinous junction has a different mm-hmm. transcriptional profile. So you're exactly right that there's probably different hotspots where this is probably necessary or functional and other places where it's not.
Yeah, and Abigail Mackey was on the podcast as well, so people can go and look her up. And then the other thing I saw just before when I was doing a bit of reading before you came on was that there was a science paper saying that with muscle damage from exercise, that the myonuclei are actually like moving to the area to, you know, convert the DNA to messenger RNA and produce some proteins, I'm assuming, to then work on fixing that bit of muscle.
Yeah, that paper blew my mind. It's really cool. It's really interesting. I think our paper that we recently came out with kind of complements some of that stuff quite nicely. Then, you know, this idea that the nuclei are not all the same. They're not all doing the same thing. They're migrating. There might be a lot more to the myonuclei than we've given it credit for.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. It's been great to chat. What I'd like to do at the end is just do a few take-home messages that you'd like to take for people to take away from this chat, which I think you just sort of said one there. That there's more going on than we think, but
yeah. Maybe. Well, I think the couple things, maybe two that I can clearly most clearly state that I've already stated that, you know, when we're doing these studies of aging and health, exercise by far the best thing. Okay. So we're going to continue to work on drugs for the people because we're not going to be able to get everybody to exercise. But if you have the option, exercise is the best thing. Okay. And we say exercise, but it's physical activity. It's just doing something. Right? Something is better than in nothing. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, you know, we have all these tracer studies in protein turnover and You know, if you're not an expert or a tracer expert, you can kind of just read those studies and take them at face value. But I think a lot of the method, and it gets into the weeds quite a bit, but the way these studies are done actually can really impact our take-home message from those studies. So you have to pay attention to the methods and the approaches. And I think we're learning a lot right now by just, you know, using some new and different approaches. And that maybe not everything is as we've always been led to believe. You know, it's continuing to question some of these things that we hold as truth that allows the field to make progress.
I was also, that's a great summary. I was also thinking you might have mentioned how, you know, it's not just simply maybe protein synthesis that's determining muscle. It's probably, you know, it's the balance of protein synthesis and breakdown. And it's partly because I think it's been easier to measure protein synthesis. And it actually reminds me of, you know, we've done stuff, we talked about AMPK before, but people tend to look at the phosphorylation, you know, the phosphoproteome, you know, the level of phosphorylation of proteins, but don't think about the dephosphorylation. You know, you take off the phosphate again, and it's going to be like a balance again, but it's harder to measure the dephosphorylation. So I think, you know, sometimes I guess people are doing what's easiest to measure, and that doesn't mean that that's what's actually going on inside.
Yeah, and you're dead on with that. And, you know, I've talked about a number of times this, you know, this concept of it's not a protein, it's thousands of proteins. So now, you know, we're trying to tackle that complexity right now. You know, we're looking at, and we're not the only ones looking at the synthesis rates and maybe even breakdown of individual proteins. You know, there's, and we're doing, you know, there's not only one cell type in muscle, so there's multiple cell types. Look, you know, it just keeps getting more and more complicated, but it each step enhances our understanding of it too. So it's hard, but it's worth doing when it's hard.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. It's been great. I really enjoyed the chat. So, okay. See you.
All right. Bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.